This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV program on Free Speech TV and on our website. Americans are under severe stress about the nation's political outlook. The American Psychological Association survey of nationwide stress found that people began worrying about the presidential election as far back as the middle of last year. But by January of this year, stress levels were extremely high, with, quote, more than half of Americans, 57%, reporting that the current political climate is a very or somewhat significant source of stress. The survey also found that two-thirds, 66%, say the same about the future of our nation, and nearly half, 49%, report that the outcome of the election is a very or somewhat significant source of stress. Those who monitor social media avidly suffer from greater stress than those who don't. It's enough to lead many of us into a deep pit of despair. But my guest thinks that our mass pessimism is misplaced and could do real harm to the progress we're making if only we would realize we are making progress. Rui Teixeira's new book, The Optimistic Leftist, contends that a 21st century will be better than you think. Rui Teixeira now joins me. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here, Sonal.
Thanks so much for joining us. So I have to admit that I think I needed to read your book at this moment. I, like many Americans, have been feeling a lot of despair, and which, of course, tends to lead to paralysis. I've experienced that paralysis myself as well. So how bad do you think it is right now? I quoted the APA's stress levels. Are you seeing it around you as well, just a lot of pessimism?
Well, I saw that particularly right after the election and, going up to the inauguration. I think certainly among a lot of the people I knew, there was a very high level of despair and stress. I would say people are starting to get a little bit more cheered up. I mean, I wouldn't say they're, delighted and super happy, but I think there are some indications that the road of Trump and the right in terms of reversing the gains of the left, as I predicted in my book, are not going to be nearly as easy as some people thought or feared. And I think the greatest example of that, of course, is what's just happened with the Affordable Care Act, where I think many people on the left assumed, well, look, Trump got elected, Republicans control the House and the Senate, pretty much within weeks, well, probably like totally nuke the Affordable Care Act and replace it with something terrible. Well, that turned out to be a lot harder to do than people thought. I mean, basically, we have a dynamic in the United States and in most other advanced countries where the gains that the left make are sticky. The right always resists them when they happen and tries to roll them back after they happen, but the nature of the beast is once you provide people with benefits and you sort of change norms around the delivery of those benefits, it's very difficult to take them away. And the left should, I think, be more cognizant of that, and it would make them less depressed when terrible things happen like Trump gets elected. Yes, it is bad. And yes, they will do some real harm. But the idea they're going to be able to destroy all the gains of the left within a matter of a few years is ludicrous. It's just not going to happen.
Now, we have a tendency on the left to be pessimistic, but for example, so does the right. So here's what I'm thinking. When you have had Republicans in power, and even when they're sort of struggling to remain in power, you always have an extreme faction of the right wing pushing those Republicans further and further to the right because nothing is good enough for them. And you kind of have a little bit of that on the left under President Obama, where admittedly a lot of social progress and economic progress did happen. There were many of us on the left saying, not enough. You talk a good game, but you just haven't done enough. You are still deporting far too many immigrants. You're still giving too much away to Wall Street. Doesn't that push actually achieve progress? Can pessimism not be positive?
Well, I'm not saying, when I say that I don't think pessimism is probably the best selling point for the left, and that optimism is actually justified in a better selling point over the long haul, it doesn't mean people shouldn't be critical of the things that have been done and indeed want to go farther, because I think that's really what the left stands for is
So
trying
be
to
critical, but not
incrementally over
depressed.
time. Yeah, but don't be depressed about it. Have some confidence that if you keep pushing and you keep on insisting, you know, the Affordable Care Act is great, it probably could be better. You probably eventually get there, despite, you know, the things that, have recently happened, for example. That's what I think is the appropriate attitude, not to be totally satisfied with what's happened, but to recognize the gains that have happened are very real. They're unlikely to be completely taken away. And we can, in fact, do better, but it will take some time.
How does history illustrate that we do have reason to be optimistic? Because certainly, when we look back, even though people on the right today hail Martin Luther King Jr. as a hero, that same strain in American society, when he was alive and active, dismissed him entirely. It seems as though the right and the conservatives have always been on the wrong side of history.
Well, I mean, I think that's right. And that's certainly, again, one of the, you know, central arguments of my book is that the left is by and large on the right side of history. And in effect, history has been evolving in a way that's generally like pretty positive. We live in the most freest, most prosperous, most democratic, most tolerant era the world has ever seen. And these are all values of the left. Governments provide more for people and do more for people than they ever have before. That's also something the left has struggled for. And the right has resisted these changes every step of the way. And, you know, they absolutely nibble at the edges. They push things back at times. But if you look at the way things have evolved, it's the values and priorities of the left that eventually seem to triumph. Look, at the beginning of the 20th century, the government spending as a share of GDP in the United States was 7%. And the government did almost nothing to regulate the air, the water, food, the environment, what have you, public health. Today, the government spends 37% of GDP. It provides an enormous amount of services for people. It regulates the air, the water, the food, the environment, public health. And these things are just very hard to take away. There's a reason why all this has happened. It's because over time, we're richer and we can afford to do these things. And once they're done, people like them and they want to keep them, even if they, in the abstract, might denounce government spending or in the abstract think regulation is like too much. When it comes down, when the rubber hits the road and you're talking about taking things away from people that they like, it's very difficult to do so. And this is why the right gets hysterical about each and every reform and program the left implements, because they kind of know that. They kind of know that once it's done, it's hard to undo.
Right.
And I think the left should take that to heart. I mean, you know, we're winning over the long haul and we'll probably continue to win.
So it seems as though the example of the Affordable Care Act is quite apt on this. I remember 7 years ago when the Tea Party and extremist Republicans whipped up this frenzy, created these notions that sounded really scary, like death panels. A lot of right-wing Americans followed suit and screamed and shouted about the government getting involved in the business of healthcare. And now some of these very same people, once they've had the taste of being able to access healthcare, are really angry about the idea of losing it and angry at their own lawmakers. And it's just amazing to see that once they've had it's the same thing with Social Security and Medicare. Those same Americans who rail against government spending often rely on these programs.
That's right. And when they talk about how they want to see the government reined in, or they want the swamp drained, or they seem to approve a lot of what the stuff Trump talks about, or some Republicans talk about, that's not what they mean, that the benefits that they now receive should be taken away. They just mean in a general abstract sense, things seem to be out of control, their lives aren't going as well as they have, they'd like them to, and they want that corrected, and someone like Trump promises to do that, to make their lives better, to improve their communities, to bring jobs back. But what they don't have in mind is what Paul Ryan and his buddies in the Congress want to do, which is, you know, shrink the government, voucherize everything, privatize everything, make benefits less generous, and so on. Not at all what people have in mind.
So the fight over the Affordable Care Act is a microcosm over a broader struggle for economic justice. And that, I know, is a big part of your book, how over time, We are confronted with the problem that the French economist Thomas Piketty has pointed out, that capitalism inevitably results in greater and greater and greater inequality. Such a system is simply unsustainable, and so that the arguments that the left presents in its critiques of capitalism are likely to win out in the long term. Can you discuss that a little bit, how we see, or how important the issue of economic justice is in terms of us underpinning our struggles with that idea?
Well, here's how I define the Piketty problem. And Piketty does not necessarily say inequality will go up forever. He's talking about tendencies. So the tendency of capitalism is, as its dynamic unfolds and given certain assumptions, it's going to increase inequality. That's a tendency of the system. Now, that could be mitigated if the economy grew fast enough that even though the benefits weren't equally distributed, people still would become a lot better off over time. But the problem is that once inequality gets to a certain level, like we're seeing it today, it actually interferes with economic growth instead of promotes it. So as a result, the economy grows even slower because it's unequally distributed. People see less of that growth. And everybody starts to get very unhappy. And that's the situation we're in now. And this is what people want solved to some extent. They want to see their living standards go up faster, and not just the people at the top. They want their lives to get better. They want their kids' lives to get better. And who has at all plausible ideas about how to do that? I think the left does. I think the right does not. The right is pretty much committed to austerity doctrines, to shrinking the government, to cutting taxes for the rich. These are all things that, besides being sort of unfair, they just don't work. They're not actually going to produce faster economic growth. They're actually not going to distribute benefits better to people in society. So the left is totally on the right track in terms of the policies it wants to pursue to get the country on a faster growing, more equally distributed track. And eventually, I believe, that will win out. And I think the Democrats are already kind of united around a pretty decent program along those lines. It's a question of politics at this point. And I think that Trump has not repealed the laws of politics. And I think when he fails to produce, which he will, you know, there'll be another shot for the left. And I think at this point, the left has progressed pretty far along this equitable growth kind of path.
Right.
And
I mean,
we'll see, you know, how fast long that takes, but I think that's where we're going.
I'm sure you and I might have a whole different discussion on whether the Democrats are effective enough or not and why Hillary Clinton lost the election. But I think the more important discussion is what how people who feel that or identify as being on the left can see the forest for the trees. And this is, I think, really, really crucial, because the tendency in this particular political moment, and I've succumbed to this myself, is take a break from reading the news because it just makes me want to scream. It makes me want to tear my hair out. I'm in tears at dinner time and my children don't understand why. And some days I just wish I wasn't in the field that I am in, so I didn't have to confront the news every day. And so, you know, in terms of how we see progress in the immediate future, one can imagine, okay, let's just elect a bunch of Democrats, then you can have a counter-argument, well, that's not going to necessarily change anything because President Obama just didn't do enough, et cetera. What about ordinary Americans, the ones who are organizing the protests, the ones who want to give money to advocacy organizations? What are some steps they can take outside of the electoral process where they really can make a difference and actually feel optimistic about making a difference?
Well, I think all of those things you're describing are great. I mean, the people who helped, you know, went out there and protested about the ACA, the people who are organizing at the grassroots level, people who are contributing to the ACLU or whatever environmental organization of their choice and so on. These are all component parts of the left. But I don't think there's any way around it that in our system, if you want to affect legislation, affect the broad current of policy in this country, there's no other ballgame in town than trying to work within the Democratic Party and pushing it to take more progressive positions and to be more politically effective. And I think that's what people are doing now. And I think it's had a great effect. Compare the Democratic Party today to the Democratic Party 20 years ago. It's a different animal. It's got different politics. It's got different policies.
But there were still huge numbers of Americans that simply didn't vote. And that, to me, is also a reflection of the paralysis one feels when one feels pessimistic. That even when confronted with somebody like Trump, so many Americans chose not to vote. And rather than blaming those Americans for not voting, you know, I think it's important for us to ask the question of how can we inspire them to join movements? So, for example, we look in Europe, and you write about this in your book a little bit, there have been some very progressive political parties in Europe that have been able to make gains, but then there have been setbacks. There's also been, along with that, a rise similar to that in the US of very reactionary right-wing populist movements that have, you know, scapegoated immigrants. You've had Brexit in Britain, and somehow it doesn't seem as though the left is winning anywhere in America or in Europe if you judge it simply by the last 10 or so years.
Right. Well, certainly the point of the book is not to argue that, you know, the left sort of succeeds in a straight line kind of fashion, that it's always, you know, peaches and cream. It just goes up forever. You never lose. Of course you lose. You know, that's the nature of politics and democracy.
That's, I think, a really important point. The progress, you have two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back.
We're definitely in the one step back part of it now.
So. Let's finally discuss the all-important issue now of the sort of short-term reasons for people actually becoming active. Because, you know, every step that Trump takes should be impetus for more and more people who feel their values are aligned with the left to actually become active on the left, right? I mean, yes, we won the fight over the ACA, but then we've lost on Obama's clean power plan. We've lost on internet digital privacy rights. You know, so each of those sort of failures, or each of those setbacks, rather, that Trump deals, it feels like a blow. How important is it for people to get involved, not just sort of look through social media and like something, et cetera, but actually get involved?
Well, I think it's very important. I mean, the reaction against Trump is happening. It's coming. He's an extraordinarily unpopular president. His approval rating continues to go down. Things like the ACA debacle in Congress just makes the Republicans look like completely ineffectual and not on most people's side as they understand it. The opening is going to be there, even in 2018, to take back the House, I think, if you consider that important. Basically, you want to start pushing the political center of gravity back toward the left. And to do that, you have to, like, not only read about and disapprove of what President Trump and the Republicans are doing, but actively campaign against it, be that electoral, be that non-electoral, be that on a specific issue. You want to basically, you know, there needs to be a tsunami of disapproval against what's going on in the country. And I think the basis for that is there in the basic fact that most of what the left wants to do is pretty popular. Most of what Trump and the Republicans want to do is pretty unpopular. And that's a basis for mobilization. And, you know, it's very easy to see if we look at recent political history, just how very important mobilization is. And I think it helps to get people mobilized to be optimistic. I mean, if you always think it's like 2 minutes to midnight, and if, you know, everything doesn't come together in just the right way, and there's not a general strike, and we're all doomed, I don't think that promotes mobilization. I think that promotes demobilization and despair.
Well, Rui, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I do appreciate what you even said at the beginning of the book to cheer up, asking the reader to cheer up. So thank you.
Right on.
I will try to take that to heart. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
My guest is Rui Teixeira. He is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we've been talking about his book, The Optimistic Leftist, Why the 21st Century Will Be Better Than You Think. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.